Hey everyone, we've got something a little bit different for you this week. This is the very first episode we ever recorded. It is just me and Jason, because it's before we asked Kevin and Jenny to be part of the show. But Kevin and Jenny will be back next week in an episode we're about to record in a couple of days. So sit back and enjoy probably the roughest thing we've ever recorded. Welcome to the Regrettable Century Podcast. I'm Chris.
And I'm Jason.
And this week, we are going to introduce the podcast and talk about capitalist realism. But first, we want to kind of just, you know, introduce ourselves and talk about where we come from politically, get a grip on what it is that's motivating us to actually make a podcast. Because Lord knows, the world doesn't really need another leftist podcast at this point, does it?
Oh, I'm doing it for the likes.
For the likes? Oh, yeah. This will be sure to make us Twitter famous. Absolutely. This is going to be wildly popular.
It's going to make us Twitter famous, and then we can monetize it and be premium content creators.
We will be influencers. We'll have to start a YouTube channel and do unboxing of all of the cool, like, cosmetics and stuff that people send us as a result of our highly influential status.
We'll review the various kinds of licorice that I like to eat.
So why are we starting another leftist podcast?
Well, so for me, I'm one of those people who finds everything just a little bit inadequate. And I don't mean that, like, I'm going to make the good left-wing podcast, but rather I feel like, in terms of political development, that I think that we are somewhat arrested and stuck in stasis. And so I would like to have a podcast, even if nobody ever listens to it, just to talk out and think through the impasse that I feel like we are in as a left. So it's more like a laboratory, like a workshop, or like a writer's room for my own political thinking.
Okay, yeah, that's about where I'm at, and I just think that as typical straight white males, of course, we're going to start something that we broadcast to the world at large, wherein we work out whatever shit is in our heads.
Right, you know? I would like to think out loud at everyone.
Exactly. No, I mean, we're not forcing anyone to listen to us. It's not like we're doing this in the supermarket, like in a crowded aisle.
Well, okay, I thought we were going to be podcasting from inside the supermarket.
But yeah, absolutely. I think that as far as our circles of activists and within our political organizations, the kind of things that we aim to talk about on the show aren't necessarily something that is useful for on-the-ground organizing. Or if it is useful to on-the-ground organizing, it's not useful for on-the-ground organizing without being worked out extensively, right? Like, you don't raise your hand in a work group meeting that's talking about organizing over tenants' rights by saying, hey, look, I just kind of wanted us to unpack the idea that it's okay to think that everything that we have ever done as the left has been a complete and utter failure, and we need to start over from scratch and trying to figure out what it is we're going to do.
Right. I think that there is a time and a place for those things, and sitting in my bedroom with headphones on might be a more appropriate place than in an organizing meeting, you know, where we have to decide on something.
Exactly.
Well, we should talk about a little bit about what sort of brought us to this point, because we've been involved in the, let's say, broadly defined project of trying to build a socialist left for the entirety of my adult life, which actually starts as far back as joining the Young Communist League as a teenager, and sort of weaving my way through the sort of third camp Trotskyist left, and being an organizer of a number of different things. And the sort of, for me, my own personal legacy with all of that is that there has been less and less space to think through contradictions and problems and doubts,
right,
and ideas which are anathema or heretical or uncomfortable, things that make us feel bad. So now that I'm a member of the Democratic Socialists of America, and for better and for worse,
there are like no rules, man.
Right, for better and for worse, I can do whatever I want. So I'm going to use some of that freedom to try to do this thinking out loud. And then hopefully that makes me a better organizer, a better fighter for my class, when I'm in the space with other people doing the work.
Exactly, yeah.
Because I don't think that we should ever just... I have this brilliant notion. You might hear me out. I don't think that we should just have theory or practice, but we should have some sort of marriage of the two.
Hold on, man. You might want to slow down. So yeah, I come from the exact same political tradition that you do. I actually became a member of the... Actually, like, a very soft member of the Communist Party, because I don't think I ever sent in my dues to them, but for some reason they sent me literature all the way until I asked them to stop, you know. So that's how well-run of an organization that was. You know, I filled out an online application, never sent in a dues check, and then they mailed me thousands of dollars worth of literature. They mailed me lots of literature, like it... as if I were going to be the one distributing it to people.
Well, you distributed it to some people.
Yeah, I just gave it away to all my friends and was like, hey, you guys ever heard of communism?
Well, like before I read the Bill of Rights Socialism, which you gave me, I was a punk rock anarchist. And right. Just despairing about how awful the world was. And, you know, socialist literature gave me some sense that, like, there's a practical response to the tangible horrors of the society I lived in. And now, 20 years later, almost, trying to figure out how to deal with the intangible horrors of the society I live in. But that path began whenever you handed me some communist literature. So, you know, it wasn't all for nothing.
Right. I grew up in a very sort of... had a very constrictive upbringing, where I was taught as a very young person that the church was... 100% correct. And the way that we did things was the way the church said to do things. And then I moved into an organization politically where party was 100% correct and we did things that way. And then I moved into another organization that says, well, you know, the Communist Party was wrong, Trotsky was correct. And the third camp of Trotskyism is absolutely correct and there's no way to think about things outside of that. And now I'm, you know, sort of out in the ether politically, trying to understand everything that I've ever been taught, be it religious, everything that I was raised with religiously, with ideas of spirituality, everything that I was raised with in the Communist Party, my punk rock upbringing having given me sort of just ridiculous, rebellious attitudes and insights into everything, and my sort of tanky leanings being a member of the Communist Party, and then being a member of third camp Trotskyist organizations, I've come out the other end of that, an amalgamation of everything, definitely influenced, not in equal parts necessarily, by all of those, and instead of eschewing any of them, embracing parts of all of them.
For me, it's pretty similar. My political thought is sort of a synthesis of a whole lot of things that I've kind of tried to absorb and sort of test out over a number of years. And probably the best thing that ever happened for that was kind of cutting loose from a tradition, right? Like from an organization, from a milieu that defined itself in terms of carrying forward kind of a legacy, a grand tradition that we inherited from the past. And I think that I'm much more interested now in trying to construct a socialism of the 21st century, something that might look similar to the past in some ways, but hopefully is primarily informed by new things that we have yet to experience and from which we can sort of discover new thought.
Yeah, I agree. I think that any kind of socialism that we build for the 21st century or in the 21st century for the 22nd century is going to have to be a socialism that takes into consideration the fact that industrial society is completely collapsed and the oceans are now, you know, inland much further than they ever were before and all the coastal cities are under a boiling acid ocean and, you know, that all of the nuclear power plants have since melted down and we live in an irradiated hellscape. Yeah, the socialism of the 21st century is going to be a lot different. okay, at the beginning of the show, I said that we were going to be talking about capitalist realism this week. And I think it's an important thing to talk about because I think that the idea of capitalist realism is it's a very succinct way to describe the ideology of late capitalism and neoliberalism.
It's like the ideology of the whole moment we're in.
Exactly, yeah. And, you know, I've been newly introduced to this concept via Mark Fisher's book, Capitalist Realism. And I think that he did an excellent job of describing our era. The era in which we are now living and the era in which we find ourselves with a newly re-energized left for the first time in a very long time, the word socialism being bandied about, fully getting a grasp on the ideology of this epoch, right, will be absolutely necessary in finding ways to combat that ideology. So, Jason, why don't you go ahead and just give us a short little breakdown of what the concept of capitalist realism actually is.
Okay, well, capitalist realism, as a term, it sort of like encapsulates the whole framework in which we sort of see the world in the kind of end of history, postmodern, post-ideological, post-Cold War world. The notion that there is any sort of future has been kind of erased. You know, plenty of older socialists like to talk about Francis Fukuyama and the end of history thesis and how disproven that is, and like, oh, history has returned because it turns out that history never left, whatever. But I think the reason why capitalist realism is a useful concept is because despite the fact that we still live in a world of capitalist crisis and of exploitation and all and the looming climate catastrophe that which we're now living through the early stages of, none of those things have really like automatically generated a new way of thinking, right? Capitalist realism is the strictures in which we can even conceive of how to resist the effects of capitalism. Mark Fisher said that capitalist realism, as I understand it, cannot be confined to art or to the quasi-propagandistic way in which advertising functions. It's more like a pervasive atmosphere, conditioning not only the production of culture, but also the regulation of work and education, and acting as a kind of invisible barrier constraining thought and action. So, like, you've heard people say, like, it's easier to imagine the end of the world than it is to imagine the end of capitalism. And that's really, like, that sort of distills the whole concept very, very clearly. Like, even as people who oppose and, like, you know, sort of live and breathe resistance to capitalism, that it is, in fact, actually easier for us to imagine climate catastrophe or nuclear war or dystopia. An even more horrifying dystopia than the one we live in, than it is to imagine living in a world worth living in, right? And Fisher calls this the slow cancellation of the future, that through relatively sophisticated means, through every available mechanism of shaping thought over the last several decades, that we as a class, we as a society have been conditioned to think about the present moment as the set of parameters in which things can operate, and that there is no more horizon. And I feel that every day. You know, that's like a thing that we have to like consciously combat.
I remember when I first was becoming political in the late 90s and listening to punk rock and reading zines and reading literature from anti-racist action and stuff like that. The entire focus of everything was on building communities that exist outside of the influence of capitalism and doing things as an individual that will disrupt capitalism by sort of like dropping out of society or boycotting this product because it did something within the system that was too reprehensible to deal with, like sweatshops or animal testing or something like that. And that was the way I was turned on politically. And it seems now that with the death of all the old organizations that had a sort of class conscious, you know, that had class-based politics, that is what has completely taken over what counts for resistance to capitalism. The only way the left can express itself now is in lionization or demonization of companies or celebrities. So, for instance, we've got Colin Kaepernick. He is the celebrity du jour that the left is lionizing because he's decided to take a knee during the national anthem, during football games, in order to call attention to police brutality, which is, you know, that's a great thing.
Absolutely admirable and something worth celebrating as an action.
Absolutely.
You know.
As an action, right. And so now that Nike has signed a deal with him to make him the face of the Just Do It campaign, all of a sudden Nike is a good company, quote, good company.
Right.
And I've seen tons of people just be like, all right, well, Nike's got my business now.
Right.
Which
DeBoard called this recuperation, right, where you have this symbol of resistance in the form of the black athlete. He's got an afro. He's talking to kids about black power. He's talking to the world about police brutality in one of the largest companies on earth, who is, up until a week ago, was known primarily for sweatshop labor, at least among those of us on the left, has now
right.
taken a sort of one of our symbols, right, a symbol of resistance in the person of this, in the figure of Colin Kaepernick, and helped really sort of like absorb him into the brand. Like, look, Nike's woke now.
And so the reaction to that has been twofold, in that I see a lot of leftists saying, well, let's go out and buy Nike to support Colin Kaepernick, which to me is just...
It's like, nah, man, Nike's got a CEO that I think gets a little bit more support than Kaepernick.
I just can't even wrap my mind around that idea. And then there's this other idea, which is Colin Kaepernick sold out. He is no longer a figure for us to rally around, and he doesn't care about the lives of brown people that aren't in the United States. He doesn't care about the brown people working in his factories. He only cares about the ones that live in the U.S., right? Which is the exact opposite wrong way to look at the situation. And it is all wrapped up in the idea that Colin Kaepernick has to be good or bad. And he needs to either have our 100% support or our scorn.
Right. So one of the most reprehensible positions that I think you can take in politics is that the truth lies somewhere in the middle. So I want to be very clear that that's not what I think. Very often polar extremes exist for a reason, right? But I think when it comes to ascribing a value to like a celebrity, like a pop star, like a Beyonce, or to like an athlete like Kaepernick, or a company or whatever, that
right.
I think that the need to either like adopt it and sort of, this is now a part of our kind of left-wing culture, or else it's mm-hmm. the enemy, is symptomatic of an inability to think through, and this is on all of our parts, right? An inability to think through the world in much more complex and dialectical terms. So, like, Kaepernick helped bring Black Lives Matter to sports and thus to the national discussion in a way which is much harder to ignore than, like, a Black Lives Matter protest. So then that's good, right? And then Nike has taken it and tried to remold it. And Kaepernick, as a person who needs a job, right, needs to work, like, as a person in capitalist society, has accepted the offer of a paycheck for work. As many of us do.
Uh-huh.
So like...
whom amongst us has not worked for a company that did something questionable?
No one ever, right?
Right. I don't think... Bosses do not exist without fucking over workers.
Yeah. And you know, that doesn't mean that Kaepernick is a sellout, although I think it's very possible, like, this new terrain might be too difficult to navigate, and perhaps Colin Kaepernick, the man, will adopt the role of giving a kind of social justice veneer to this Leviathan that is responsible for an enormous amount of suffering and ultimately is an obstacle to human freedom.
Because
that's the dual nature of existing in capitalist society, right? So we have to think...
Exactly, yeah.
What... A much more useful question than whether or not Nike is good or bad, or whether or not Kaepernick is still, you know, on our team, is what to do with the new terrain. if Walter Cronkite says we might lose in Vietnam and it sows doubt in people's minds, that doesn't mean that Walter Cronkite becomes a good guy or that the news is on our side. It's like, okay, we have a new platform in which to not only inject doubt, but raise hope. Not about winning in Vietnam, but about ending the war. So the bigger, the more important question, the more useful discussion is like, what can we do in which, in a world where Black Lives Matter is mainstreamed by Nike? Well, what have we been doing in a world where Pride has been mainstreamed by Wells Fargo? You know?
Right.
That's the question.
By the police or the military or Israel, you know?
Right. This is a useful conversation to me because it relates to the way that we operate as a left. It's like there's a type of person that says, oh, if we win Medicare for all that does is strengthen the capitalist system because people believe that you can deliver the goods. And I think that's one of the most insane things I've ever heard. But it's not that winning Medicare for all necessarily weakens capitalism either. It's that when the class is on the move and it flexes its muscles and it makes a gain for itself, it opens the horizon. It makes the next step more possible. It's about retraining ourselves to think dialectically, you know, where there's a thesis, an antithesis, and the result of the clash between the two is a synthesis, right? That is to say, like, the creation of a new terrain in which there's a new set of contradictions. So, like, you know, electing Bernie Sanders won't bring us socialism, but electing Bernie Sanders would absolutely lay bare a new set of contradictions, give us a new terrain on which to operate as people who are interested in salvaging the world, if not exactly saving it.
Allowing Bernie Sanders a platform within our two-party system, you know, just allowing Bernie Sanders to speak, to take on the idea that the rich need to pay taxes, or that Americans deserve health care and Americans deserve to be free from student debt, has created a rupture in the Democratic Party in which they could always count on the new crop of young people to just be swept easily into the Democratic Party once they reach the true voting age, which is like, I think, 35, you know? but now that's not necessarily a given.
Yeah, seeking that rupture, that's what we exist for.
And what capitalist realism has done to the left in the United States is create within even the radical left, it was Bernie Sanders is, he's not realistic. We need to stick with a pragmatist. I even had people who were on the radical left who were refusing to vote for Bernie Sanders because they were so scared of Donald Trump. And then outside of that, you had many on the radical left who were saying, well, Bernie Sanders isn't our guy because he doesn't support revolution. He's not a true socialist. And we're going to eschew him and anyone that wants to vote for him.
Right, because he's going to, I don't know, miseducate people and make them think socialism something else.
Right.
And this purely linear way of, which is to say a purely capitalist way of thinking, right? This is capitalist realism. It's the inability to see rupture, but only to see continuity. So, like, if people like Bernie Sanders, that means they're not going to oppose capitalism because they'll only have these limited horizons that Sanders has.
Exactly.
Rather than seeing the ascendancy of a challenge of any kind to the billionaires, right? Mm-hmm. Opening up the door to a bigger challenge. Like, if you don't believe that billionaires should be taxed to pay for, like, social programs, how are you going to become convinced that they should cease to exist at all?
So what that portion of the left would rather do is continue their holding action, and that is the idea of cadre building. We're going to just put up the red flag, and anybody who agrees with us already on basic concepts like revolution is necessary, we'll bring them in. And anyone who doesn't agree with us, they're not actually socialists. And maybe once the revolution starts to kick off, then they'll see that we're the ones who are right the whole time, and they'll be drawn to us. Instead of looking at something like the idea that Bernie Sanders, who has always called himself a democratic socialist, gets a platform causes ruptures, and from those ruptures, thousands of potential Democrat voters are spilling out and waiting to be scooped up by some organization who, you know, for better or for worse, is the DSA at this point.
Right.
You know?
I think for the best right now. I think it's probably significant that what was previously one of the worst organizations on the American left is, because of how poorly organized it was and how lackadaisical it was in the way that it operated, it's significant that that's the group that attracted all the people. I don't think it's just the word democratic socialism, but because you just had a shell, you just had like a husk, you know, like almost an empty vessel that you could just pour people into.
And there's a cool rose.
You know, well,
and it's got an emoji. It's very convenient. It all works out.
People don't come at you with like, all right, here's the tradition. Are you going to adopt it? Oh, is that right? You're going to adopt it? Okay, prove it. You know, it's just like, hey, come be left with us. That brings all sorts of problems. But it also, it's exciting. But like, you know, on the subject of left being melancholia, like lest we sort of accidentally represent ourselves as people who
unless we accidentally come across as optimistic. Right.
Let's say in defense of pessimism, what I will say is I'm excited about Jeremy Corbyn in the United Kingdom and the Labour Party. But I remember Syriza in Greece, which is to say, I know what it looks like to have the horizon sort of open up before you, seemingly, and then to have it disappear. To have the horizon close.
Yes.
In an instant, even like the whole honeymoon period was less than a year. Mm-hmm. So like some people will draw this lesson that like, well, that's what you get for hoping. And I think maybe there's some truth to that, right? Like there's a, you know, we should disabuse ourselves of the notion that the people in motion necessarily means that there is a future, right? But what we should say is that nothing else will allow us to imagine a future.
So that right there is the triumph of capitalist realism, once again. A situation in which a Grexit could possibly call into question the economic system of Europe, call its viability into question, was something that not even the leadership of Syriza could deal with, because the thought of being on the outside of that economic sphere was just too much. It would have decimated their economy, essentially.
Well, because all they could think about it was in terms of their economy as it's presently organized, right?
Right.
Rather than like, what would it look like? Like, what would it take to make a Greece worth living in? A just Greece outside of the European Union.
And all of the accusations that were hurled at Greece, or that they were unrealistic, that they were suicidal, all of the debates about whether or not Greece should be involved in Grexit were always done on those terms. Like, you do realize that there is no other way that you could possibly do things, right? And they would be like, well, yes, but you see, you know. And that was the example that Spain and Portugal and Italy were given in that period.
Right, talk about that. That would be the rapid cancellation of the future right there. You know, where there's a moment where you thought, hey, we can not pay back the debts, we can restructure the society, we could be more democratic, we could be more fair. And then Greece fails and everybody kind of falls into line. Because, oh no, we can't. Very obviously we can't.
Right.
The best we can do is mitigate the worst of the suffering caused by the unchangeable nature of our society. As Margaret Thatcher said, there is no alternative. Look at what happens to people who try.
I mean, the alternative is the rise of the far right, which is on the ascendancy in every single one of those countries.
Right. Which is why we should be pessimists. Because the failure of the soft left does not in any way open up the door for success of the hard left. But rather, it's swings the pendulum back the other way, as we've been seeing.
As we saw in the Spanish Civil War in Italy in the 1920s, and germinated during World War II and all throughout history.
And post-perestroika Russia, right? Where, like, the reform process didn't work, and so now you have the creation of all sorts of weird ultra-nationalist far-right fantasies with very real, like, sort of very dangerous real consequences on the ground.
One of the things that Mark Fisher talks about is that the death of the Soviet Union allowed for the Francis Fukuyama moment, which was the end of history, this is all that there is nothing else, and accelerated the process of neoliberalism. There's nothing for the workers of the world to look to anymore, so we don't really have to worry about the draconian measures we're going to take to neuter them, to smash the unions, to remove the social safety nets. And everyone from the Democratic Party in the United States to the labor parties, the nominally socialist labor parties of the European Union and Great Britain, implemented a process of neoliberalizing their economies.
So much so that now in this country, in order to deal with the problem of traffic congestion and the sort of immobility of the individual in urban space, one of the most creative things we can come up with is to dump a bunch of scooters out in the middle of the street and say, hey, pay us to use these. And people go, oh, hey, what a great fucking solution.
Those things are a fucking blight.
Yeah. I mean, if there was any, if we really lived in a society in which the government looked out for people, then city governments would be impounding Bird scooters. Company would go out of business, or they would be taxed into oblivion, and they would build better public transit, like real, genuine public transit.
What's interesting to me, though, is that congestion in society is a problem, and mass transit has been defeated as a concept. It's not even on the table for Los Angeles. It's not on the table for Austin, Texas. It's not on the table for any of the big cities in the South. The idea of mass transit has been defeated. It's like a 50-year-long process of like strangling mass transit. So we have things like Uber and things like Lyft, which are wildly popular, but also Uber gets pilloried in the press time and time again for the way they raise rates. And stuff
I was going
like
to say, like, at least the train doesn't cost $40 at peak hours and $3
right.
when there's very few riders. At least it's like a flat rate that you can count on.
So now these scooters are being put out as like sort of a, hey, look, Uber sucks. I don't want to give anyone my address, and I don't want to support these companies like Uber and Lyft. So instead, we've got another startup with the disruptive idea. That's their big thing.
It's a disruptive idea, all right. I have to step over them on the sidewalk and swerve around them at the corner because sometimes they fall into the street.
Or watch out, like when we were on the in Santa Monica. We're walking down the sidewalk, and you know, those guys would zip by us on either side without letting us know they were coming. It'd be very easy to get your leg broken by one of these assholes. And today, driving around in Austin, Texas, I was almost hit by one in my truck. That would have probably turned out worse for him than me, but still, you know.
I was gonna say, oh my God, is your truck okay?
Yeah, this dude was hauling ass through a parking lot, not paying any attention to what was going on, hopped over a speed bump and like almost ran into me because he was looking down to make sure that he got over the speed bump. But anyway, that's not my political problem with those stupid fucking scooters, right? My political problem is that it's just another neoliberal solution to a very real problem, and that is the problem of how to get people to where they need to go.
Which is further and further away from their homes all the time.
Which is further and further away from their homes because they can't afford to live in their homes because we don't have rent control. Because we've got gentrification, and gentrification happens because we've got tech and other sorts of industries moving into places that were historically minority neighborhoods and causing...
Well, and because development capital is what's kept the economy afloat ever since the Second World War. That and the permanent arms economy, right? But like, if you could conceivably restrict investment in that, like that, you know, housing bubble, and the sort of perpetual expansion of our urban centers, you might go into another capitalist crisis.
Point being that neoliberalism causes a problem, and neoliberalism throws at us a solution, which causes a problem, which throws at us a solution. Which
exacerbates a problem.
Which exacerbates a problem and causes another problem. What I'm saying is that this is not really a solution. It's sort of a band-aid that's going to cause another problem. You know, this, the way capitalism solves all of its problems is it, you know, gives us cars, it gives us ethanol to make gasoline cleaner that we get from corn, and we monocrop corn and destroy the environment that way. It gives us soy so we could stop eating meat, so we could stop polluting the earth by putting methane and waste. What that does, they monocrop soy and they destroy the environment that way, and so on and so on and so on, you know, and so on and so on.
Right, so the point here is that not only do we live in a dystopia, not only is the horizon nothing but a hellscape, but that we have to have a solution which is so much more imaginative than anything we've had in the past. That the socialism of the 21st century is going to have to be much more nimble, much more creative than the socialism of the 20th century. If only because all we have to look back on is an inspiring and grand set of failures.
Brief flashes of brilliance followed by prolonged catastrophe. As examples, I mean, the Russian Revolution followed by Stalinism. Allende followed by Pinochet. You know,
the whole anti-colonial wave across Africa and Southeast Asia.
Followed by Ba'athism and Gaddafi. And
well, and yeah, the people who won all of those fights ended up making the shoes for Nike.
Right.
Right, so it's just to show how deeply rooted capitalist realism is.
Right.
It's like, all right, yeah, we've won our independence, but now we really got to build up the economy, and the only way to do that is to sell products to the former colonial powers.
It's worth noting that the Ba'athists are socialist in name, and so was Gaddafi. Gaddafi, who collaborated with the United States in the War on Terror and was a source of cheap labor for the Western powers and everything else. Same with Saddam Hussein and, you know, Bashar al-Assad and the Assad family anyway. Capitalist realism is pervasive enough so that the socialists' grandest vision is one of perhaps maybe receiving universal health care under capitalism. And I'm not trying to, like, talk shit about anybody whose greatest goal in life is to receive universal health care, because, I mean, that's going to be something we're probably fighting for until we die, you know?
All those healthcare losers, right? Man. healthcare would be swell. I would love to have healthcare as good as they have in other capitalist countries.
Right.
Here's the thing. I think that, like, a thesis that I would like to explore throughout the show, so let's say throughout my political life from here on out, that I think it's positive, it's to be lauded, the reemergence of social democracy on a mass scale.
Right.
But also about the impossibility and the impracticability of social democracy a second time around. That, like, it's an important opening up of space politically, psychologically, but that we don't have that in order to achieve the desired gains of the reform movement of labor, we will require Herculean revolutionary struggle.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think we have seen the sort of limitations of that project in the past, which is to say we should push for it, but we should recognize that in pushing for it, we have to push beyond it in order to achieve it. Otherwise, we're all going to drown in a nuclear sea.
Yeah, and I think that you and I had talked about this earlier, the idea that we're going to even have a world left to build socialism in is appearing to be less and less likely as the years go on. The way that the climate is heating up is, I mean, we've got not much more than a century left of having a livable planet, you know?
Maybe like a half century, even.
If we were to seize power now and implement the most draconian methods of reversing climate change.
Eco-Stalinism.
Eco-Stalinism, right? We might have a world in which we can continue to live in 40 years from now. But
we might yet still have a world in which we could we could conceivably map out a future on what we've got.
But anything short of that is going to be a world in which the equatorial regions are unlivable. Everyone's going to have to move out of Sub-Saharan and Sub-Saharan Africa. Everyone's going to have to move out of the tropics. The tropics are going to become a desert. That's the short term. That's like by 2050, you know? We might conceivably have a world that is in extreme famine and being depopulated as a result of starvation and wars over scarce resources. So at this point, it might be the only thing that we might even be able to conceive of in our most wild, in our wildest utopian fantasies is like salvaging the remnants of the human race in order to be able to construct some sort of pre-industrial guild socialism or something.
That's a rousing call if ever I heard one.
I can see the posters now. What sort of post-apocalyptic world do you want to build?
Do you want to use the last few habitable zones to build a socially equitable society? Or do you want to use them to continue destroying the possibility of life on the...
At this point, Elon Musk and everyone else will have started their colony on Mars. So the biggest political questions we might have to deal with will be things like, are you going to fight Emperor Baron Trump's slave-catching ships when they come from Mars to take us to work in the Amazon factories? Or are you going to submit like a dog? I will gladly hold the banner with Colin Kaepernick's face and the Nike swoosh up high on top of the barricades, machine gunning the mech warriors from Mars as they round up slaves for the bases.